The Babylon Podcast was our last best hope for B5 fans. A self-contained show, 1 hour long, located on an RSS feed. A place for interviews and episode discussions for a whole bunch of humans and aliens. A shining beacon in cyberspace, all alone on the web. It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, the year the Lost Tales came upon us all. This is the podcast about the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2007. The name of the show is The Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
Oh, happy Koshmas! It's Santa Kosh!
And I have a special present for you. I brought along to our, the Babylon Podcast engineer, editor, buddy, pal, save us all the time. Brad Bauer's with us tonight. Say hi, Brad.
Hi, Brad.
Thank you. You can leave hi, now. Brad. Thank you.
Hey, I got a question for you, Jeffrey.
Uh-huh.
Santa Kosh.
Yeah.
How do the children sit on his lap when he has no lap to sit on?
It's a secret that mostly only Catholic priests know about.
Oh, no, he didn't.
That's Jeffrey at...
where were you going with that question?
I was just curious. I wasn't going anywhere. It just occurred to me. You know,
Santa Kosh actually works for the U.S. Post Office. He's the guy that gets those letters that all the kids send.
Oh, there we go. Gotcha. Yeah. He answers. Well, it says, you know, Santa Kosh, could I have a pony for Christmas? Yes. Santa Kosh, could I have a bicycle for Christmas? Yes. Yeah, that's easy. Easy job.
And I know that most of the country, meaning the United States, for our foreign listeners, is battling brutal ice storms, and it's insanely miserable. And I just wanted you to know that it's 60 degrees here, and I'm freezing. So you're not alone out there, okay?
It was 75 degrees today here in Richmond.
No way. It was like 55 here. It's not right.
It was actually pretty warm around here the past couple days, too.
Really?
You know what this means? Yeah. You guys are going to get more ice this weekend.
No kidding.
just off after Sunday. So
for all intents and purposes, most all football no longer being available on television, I'm totally jonesing and having terrible seasonal withdrawal right now.
No football.
And for those of you not in the United States, that's football. That is football.
the funny shaped ball, right?
Yeah. Right. Well, you know what? Just to add to this metric buttload of misery here, Jeffrey, you forward on to us an email that JMS had posted, and I don't have
and that came to us that came to us from our loyal listener Jim Carr. Jim, yeah. I ran into Jim in town here the other night and at a screening, and he quickly sent that to me. So I forwarded to you because you know how to interpret such data.
Well. Like I said, I fail miserably and didn't print out the actual text, but the long and the short of it is this. JMS is responding to the queries regarding the situation with the writer's strike. And what he says is, this is generally how it's different than what it was in 88. In 88, JMS says, the Writers Guild was a fractious lot. And ultimately, the studios and the producers were able to play one faction against the other, television writers versus film writers versus, you know, all the other types and flavors. And so, in a sense, they were able to pit each against the other to shorten the strike and get their way. The difference, JMS writes, this year is that all these writers are watching these DVD box sets of television series and movies and whatever else flying off the shelves in record numbers. And all of the writers are united now, seeing how everybody's product is taking off and they're not getting hardly any residuals off of it. They've banded together. And the great maker recounts meeting with some Warner Brothers executives over lunch just as they were getting things kicked off for The Lost Tales. And this executive basically said, oh, you know, we're not worried about the writer's strike. It's going to be over very quickly. And in JMS's own words, he says this guy does not realize the wood chipper that he is heading into. And what this means specifically for Babylon 5 fans is that JMS revealed that he took a look at the calendar some time ago, called up Warner Brothers and said, hey, if you guys want to have more Lost Tales as soon as you can, you guys need to commission a script so that I can get working on it before the writer's strike happens. And their response was, well, we refuse to make any decisions based under pressure. So, I think, boys and girls, we are in for a long, long year.
Yeah.
It's probably going to be 12 months long.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, do the math.
On that note, we have a lot of Babylon 5 novels here, just waiting for new homes. You need to get some reading in, don't you?
Yes, absolutely. It makes me wonder, you know, with the decision that Sci-Fi made with Battlestar Galactica, holding it off until January, the new episodes,
mm-hmm.
makes me wonder, because both Ike and Ron Moore being writer types, I wonder if that was not some sort of a forethought that they got together the Sci-Fi network people and said, you know, here's the deal, this is what's going down. I don't know.
It's entirely possible.
It just casts that all in a new light. So there we are.
Hey, Summer, I saw that on the website today. Tell me a little bit more about these books. What are you trying to do with them?
We went out and adopted, Brad actually helped a lot with this, adopted the abandoned Babylon 5 novels that we saw in used bookstores. In most cases, they're the ones people already had, the numbered ones from 1 to 9, but some people were missing trilogy books, and we've actually rescued a few of the trilogy books. I rescued 3 out of the 5 season by season guides by Jane Killick. I had a season 1, a season 2, and 2 season 3s, and you know, just said, hey, I bought these, you know, just pay me what I bought them for, plus shipping, and they're yours. And literally, people just snapped them up. And we're trying to get either an exchange system going or just trying to find homes for these Babylon 5 books or Babylon 5 related books, because a lot of people missed them when they came out. I mean, think how many new fans have come to Babylon 5 in the past 5 years. These books, most of these books haven't been available.
But do you guys still have a enough of a resource at the studio there that Farpoint Media can now be the repository for all things Babylon 5, so that
actually when, the Babylon 5 books are in my den.
That's much safer.
Michael made me take them home.
Well, that's because Michael has beer stains all over everything in there.
No, it's because my mountain of books is bigger than my couch now.
Yes, yeah. There's I can vouch that there is a huge stack of delivered books, I guess, since about October. That's pretty impressive.
Mm. Yeah, very nice.
Yeah,
very
so
nice.
There. Yeah, but no, the Babylon 5 books. I'm all for anyone who can give me suggestions on how to either make this a system where you read a book and you pass it to the next person who wants it in line, or people who want certain books to buy them. Because we do have, I think, I don't know if Brad found them or if Thomas found them, complete trilogies for the Centauri Prime trilogy, the Psycop trilogy, and the Technomage trilogy, including the hard-to-find books that go on Amazon for like $40 each.
Yeah, I think this is something that Oprah's going to be interested in.
I scoured a lot of Kentucky looking for those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was going to say probably exchange would be better so that we can share the wealth amongst all the fans. But that's something we can work out. If, you know, maybe that's something people send us emails, what you think, whether it should be, you know, first come, first serve purchase, or if, you know, we fans have enough faith in each other to send them out and circulate them and get them to the next person.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should loan them out like a library and have a very short borrowing time so that we can immediately start charging for late return fees.
Ooh, like hours.
Yeah, Koshbusters.
You have 6 hours to read this book.
But yeah, no, because like some of the books are more easily found than others. I mean, some of them you can get on Amazon used books for like 50 cents. But I'm more interested in seeing what's in the used book stores, because some of those books have been forgotten. I don't think anybody realized that how valuable those season by season guides are, and I was just dumb lucky to see them on the shelf. I'm like, oh wow, there's three of them, and I kept my eye out. And when the fourth and the fifth one came out, I grabbed them. And if I had known that they would be this hard to find, I would have picked up extras to lend out to people or sell.
Right. Well, that gets back to the age old tale with Babylon 5, that as a franchise, you know, that Warner's hasn't quite realized what they have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other books we haven't found extras are, I mean, the Dining Guide. That's a, you know, average $150. You know, and Jeffrey chuckles. There's the security, the Babylon 5 security manual by Michael Garibaldi, for James Mortimer also. But that one, you know, I'd like to find some extras of that one to get to people, because that's actually kind of funny. There's an A to Z guide to Babylon 5 by David Bassam.
Mm-hmm.
And
that.
Yeah, there's two versions of it. Did you get the British version or the American paperback version?
I got the American paperback.
Okay, well, Brad or somebody, I think it might have been Brad, somebody found me like three copies of those. I'm like, wow, I haven't seen this version. And it was the American version. I had always seen the trade paperback British version. Yeah,
I didn't know there was such a thing.
There was such a thing. Because Titan Books. Actually, this guy, David Bassam, he's the same guy who's written the good season guides from Galactica. Actually, the first season guide was good. The second one was
Yeah.
But yeah, no, if people are interested in some of these books, let me know. I had actually started to set up a store under Babylon Podcast where people could, you know, either buy them or, you know, we could use it somehow to loan them out and have them keep going to the next in line.
Yeah.
And we had some technical issues and moving servers, and so that's kind of on hold now.
Yes. Yeah. Stuff going on. All right. Well, any other thoughts to wrap this segment up with?
Yeah, you got a tease for next week's show? Or do we is that a secret? Are we
actually
not supposed to talk about it yet?
The tease I want is, are we going to set up Kosh's blog?
We're working that. We're working that. There's some I'm working it, kiddo. I'm working it. There's
okay.
There's just some file a domain transfer stuff that was so out of date that it requires like reinventing the wheel.
Wow.
But anyway, it's all good. It's all going to happen. I just didn't want to promise that would happen by next week.
That's fine. I was going to say that similar to take on the there we go, for in English for all us human fans. I have been diligently going through this past year's material to start compiling for our holiday special, and the reason I bring that up only because there's a handful of references to the Dining on Babylon 5 book, and Jeffrey chuckles throughout, and Summer is extremely envious. But it's just funny to hear it again. There's some recurring themes that are timeless on this podcast. That seems to be one of them.
I can't remember. Did I appropriately glow that I have a piece of Kosh now? Was that on the show? Was that on the live feed? I don't remember.
From the live feed.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
So all the regular listeners missed it.
Well, you should make a necklace out of that.
I actually have it in the shadow box right now.
Oh, well, that's cool, too.
That's appropriate.
See, that's kind of ironic, isn't it?
That's shadow box.
I was wondering when someone was going to pick that up.
Well, maybe the shadow box could hang from a chain around your neck. It'd be very urban.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of be like
bling.
Yeah, exactly. Flavor of Summer.
Right.
Flavor Brooks.
Sporting that bad bling.
That's quite all right.
So it's been another fantastic year. Is this the end of our third calendar year?
End of our second.
No, it
really?
it is. Well, officially, the end of our second year in existence would be beginning of February.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
But we calendar. Are approaching. Yeah.
Calendar year. Sorry.
Right.
Not calendar. Calendar year.
Yeah. Yes. Have I talked to you about my ancestors, Aztec and Mayan?
I bet you took a lot of crap for that as a kid, huh?
Oh, you know, yeah. But I took a lot of crap for a lot of things as a kid.
Yeah. And your name was the
if
least...
If I knew then what I know now, I would make sure that I had a tactical nuclear missile with me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
All right.
All right, let's take us out of here for a break.
What else are we doing on this show?
We are going to be deep geeking.
Oh.
Oh.
Yep.
is that the music?
This is the music. This is a break. We're coming back to talk about
93 episodes later. We still haven't got it together.
More work for me to
do. I was creating the pause for Tim to jump in there, but deep geeking right after this.
Yeah. The year it all happened or something like that.
In a world where we wait for a new Farscape series, one small crew sends out a beacon of hope to scapers everywhere.
Hi, this is Ben Browder.
Hi, I'm Claudia Black.
Hi, I'm David Franklin.
Hi, this is Rayleigh Hill.
Hi, this is Paul Goddard.
Hi, I'm Gigi Edgley, and you're listening to Escapecast.
Hi, everyone.
Attention. Last time in our hero's journey.
La, la, la.
Well, you are, she says as she's knocking John out with her rifle.
I'm Wendy Hembrock with the news.
Yeah, baby, it's time once again.
My word.
L-M-N-O-P.
You know, I'm tired of these mother frelly stings on my mother frelling Leviathan.
Holy cannoli.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer will be dead.
Oh, no.
You can find the Scapecast at scapecast.org.
Every time I think that there's more to you than a pair of pushed-up loomers and a corset.
Luma.
If only we had some way to keep up our stamina.
Naughty mist.
Does Mummy know your hair?
Oh, no. Mummy doesn't know.
Here's your rematch, Crichton.
What a lovely fantasy of family reconciliation.
Where's your neck?
Shut up.
The Scapecast, your guide to the wonders of Farscape.
Digging down to the obscurest facts in fandom, this is Deep Geeking.
And we are back with this week's Deep Geeking. Right smack dab in the middle of the third season. We're in the middle of the roller coaster ride. We are.
Yes.
And I love this. And Ceremonies of Light and Dark can be viewed by some as a slight pause, but it really isn't when you look at all the things that happen in there.
Whereas the intensity of Severed Dreams is external for the most part. You know, I mean, we've got the, you know, Sheridan has to come to grips with making the decision to break away from the Earth Alliance and all that, but it's all very much sound and fury and very exciting. Ceremonies of Light and Dark is extremely personal on many levels. So while it doesn't necessarily have the fireworks of a Severed Dreams, I think it like you say, it keeps that same intensity just in a different level. And the crux of the episode revolves around one remnant of Night Watch on board the station planning to do their damage against Sheridan. And the episode opens with Sheridan walking through the Zocalo through the station, and he is greeting the denizens of the station, but he's also being watched and nearly gunned down at that point by a trigger-happy individual. But his hand is stayed because, as it's pointed out, that if you just shoot him, somebody will step up and take his place. And that's not what they need. They need to, you know, he'll become a martyr at that point. And they need to discredit him. And the way to try to do that is they take Delenn hostage. She is getting ready for a rebirth ceremony.
Yes.
We've already seen the rebirth ceremony in the first year. At least a portion of it.
Yes. But the more important part is a letting go so that healing can begin, I believe, is the intent of this part of the ceremony.
Right. And she thinks that now is a good time, what with everything that's been going on, that is a certain matter of her birth that has to take place.
And I love how everyone is really too busy. They're like, well, I got a lot going on, but I'll try to make it. You know, everybody has the same excuse, the same reason to duck out, so to speak.
Right. And Dolan expresses a certain amount of consternation about that. but she's determined to go through with it anyways. However, her planning is interrupted as she is greeting the commander of one of the Minbari ships that helped defend Babylon 5 from imminent attack from Earth Force cruisers. She and the commander are abducted by this Night Watch cell. And their plan is basically to torture and kill Delenn and set up Sheridan to take the fall so that not only do they get rid of Sheridan and Delenn, but they are working to try to fracture the fragile alliance between the Minbari and the Renegade Station.
And also bring B5 back into Alliance hands. That's really what they want. They know Babylon 5 is an important station, an important location, and they want it back in their hands.
Right. And, you know, the guy with the knife is creepy as hell. You know, he's one of those stone-cold killer types, similar to the Mad Bomber we had in Convictions. You know, I mean, he's just completely unhinged.
Yeah.
But almost hyper-real. You know, I mean, he is just a shell of a man, and all he has that he's good for anymore is torturing and killing and maiming. A number of occasions he has to be reined in because he doesn't see the bigger picture. The Minbari commander starts taunting him and basically trying to get him to act before their plans are, you know, where they need it to be. These nice Night Watch guys, and they, you know, the commanding individual has to rein him in.
Mm-hmm.
The abduction of Delenn, of course, causes great consternation amongst the command staff.
And it enrages Marcus to no end.
Yes. There is that classic scene where he goes into the bar and down below, just sits himself down, and starts dealing himself into the card game, and you know, so this is what I need to know. You know, you people are going to tell me.
I think his exact words were, "Some bad guys have taken my friend. It dawns on me that you are bad guys. So I want you to tell me where I can find these bad guys, because somebody here knows someone who knows someone who knows something, and I'm not leaving until I get that information."
Right.
And then his ultimatum.
And then he proceeds to trash the place. Mm. And I love it. He's completely, you know, they come back to the bar, and he's wiped up the last guy. The place is a wreck. There's nobody staying except for Marcus. And he just goes, "Oh, bugger, now I have to wait for somebody to wake up."
Yeah. And it's great, the prelude to that, because he says, they're like, "What are you going to do?" He says, "Well, in 5 minutes, I'll be the only one at this table still standing. In 5 minutes after that, I'll be the only one in this room still standing."
Right.
And you just look, they're laughing their asses off. And he's just got this look of, "Oh, you ain't seen nothing yet," on his face. And it's just wonderful, because you're wondering, okay, what exactly is he going to do? We've seen him fight before, but when they come back and literally everybody else but him is on the floor, and the two people who are trying to fight their way past him, not fight him, fight past him to get out of the room, and he takes them out too.
Right.
And it's just wonderful. He's looking around and he's ready to hit somebody else. Oh, bugger, now I have to wait for someone to wake up. And you're like, whoa.
Yeah. And then there's the hand on his shoulder.
Yes.
And he whips around. There's Lanier, who also takes up the defensive position.
I'm sorry, this is like one of my favorite scenes ever in the whole series. And he's like,
it's a great scene between the two of them. And this is where the tragedy of Lanier is laid bare. They get to talking, and Marcus, and basically Marcus calls Lanier out. He thinks Lanier is not doing enough to help find Delenn.
Mm-hmm.
And basically wants to restrain him and, you know, grab him by the collar and say, you know, your reaction isn't what it should be. Yeah. Well, when Marcus does that, Lanier picks him up off the floor. And this is great. You know, here's Marcus. He's just cleared out this bar. He's just beating everybody up. And Lanier, you know, they, in the hierarchy of things, you know, Lanier, at least when he's angry, and you don't ever get to see him angry like this, or impassioned is a better way to look at it. And it was, what does he tell Marcus? He says, never touch me like that again. I may look like you, but we are not the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically reminding Marcus that, you know, the Minbari are not humans. But he goes on to say that part of their birth ceremony is telling someone something that you have had as a secret, or something that you've been holding on to, and, you know, in a manner of honoring Delenn, this is as good a time as any.
Mm-hmm.
And I love her.
Yeah, and that's the bombshell where you go, oh, he actually admits it. Okay.
Yeah, I know she's pledged for another, for someone, you know, what does he say, for someone
yeah,
greater?
She is fated for another. But my love is not romantic love, as you call it. It's a pure, higher form of love. And you're going, yeah, that's a pure, higher form of BS.
I was going to say, you just keep telling yourself that, Mr. Lanier.
And that was literally one of the times I'm like, wow, I hadn't seen just self-delusion so believed in a science fiction show. I'm like, whoa, usually you see that with the crazy, you know, villain who everybody's about to just, you know, just whoop on. But this is one of the good guys who is living in a dream world.
Yeah. And you know from that point, because it's, at this point, it's very plain that Sheridan and Delenn got a thing going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's definitely
that, of course,
some
is driven home at the end of this episode. But this, you know, talk about something else that just comes into the whole mix.
Yeah.
And Marcus, you can knock over with a feather, too, at that point.
Yeah, he was like, didn't see that one coming.
Yeah,
Thank you for honoring me with your secret, but whoa.
Right, yeah.
Yeah,
so
that's,
they,
No, before, I like, literally, my favorite part of this entire episode is when Marcus admits to Lanier about his training. He says, they said I was carrying around a lot of repressed anger, and I'm not repressed anymore.
Yeah, right.
The very first time I saw that, I laughed my ass off, and I missed most of the rest of what happened because I was still laughing. I was still laughing. There was no VCR to rewind. There was no TiVo to rewind. I'm like, damn it.
Yeah. So everyone's still working frantically to try to find Delenn.
Mm-hmm.
They narrow it down, listening to the recordings. They can't quite trace it because they're smart enough to the Night Watch people are smart enough to route their signal through a couple different routes, and they can't quite trace it. But they do get the sense of machinery, so that puts it down on a particular sector of the station.
And then Marcus's
Marcus throws in, how about not 19?
Yeah, his pugilistic endeavors have yielded some information, and even more than the location, an insider in Garibaldi's security staff, which kind of irks Garibaldi a little bit. He's like, what, another one?
But they use that to create a ruse wherein they basically fake a reactor leak and drive everybody out, and that drives them into a kill zone.
Mm-hmm.
Delenn is wounded, and I love that scene. Is the leader, the killer, is getting away.
Mm-hmm.
John wants to stay with Delenn. He's torn. He wants to go get the guy, but Delenn's hurt, and he wants to be by her side. And Susan says, "Go take care of him, John. She'll be fine here." You know, using his first name, which is, you know, I mean, that takes it beyond the level. You know, at that point, you know that they're friends, but this has gone beyond a tactical military situation. You know, this is a grudge match at this point. You know, so at that point you're on a first name basis, which it's just one of those little touches that I thought was great character stuff. Sheridan chases down the guy and just beats him senseless. And then similar to Marcus, he becomes unrepressed. You know, there's a sense of he's taken out much more than just, you know, you've hurt my, you know, you've hurt my partner.
Mm-hmm, yeah. You see it. You actually see it.
No more Night Watch.
Yeah. No more, you guys. You see it in his eyes, actually, right. After she's fallen into his arms. It amazed me how much, in the midst of all that chaos, you know, he's holding her. And you see like 14 different emotions on his face. He's worried. He realizes how much he cares about her. He's absolutely infuriated that these people would do this to her and that he couldn't stop it beforehand. And it just, you see just nothing but how much he loves her right there in that 2 seconds he's holding her in his arms.
That's fantastic. I love it when Sharon's beating the crap out of the guy, all the lurkers basically run. I mean, you know, it's not just, here comes trouble, let's get out of the way. It's like, you know, here comes one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, you know, riding down. And then he just, you know, it's that, like I said, he's letting go of a lot of anger and frustration and everything, you know. And then we get that wonderful scene in Med Lab where Delenn's laying there on the bed and Sharon says, you know what, when I saw you get hurt, this is when I realized that if I lost you, I didn't know what I would do. Basically says that was very important. And then comes the parade of confessions.
Yeah. That part interested me because I really didn't see all four of them turning over their uniforms. You knew that was going to be something that Sheridan would give up. You thought maybe that'd be something that Ivanova would give up. But I really didn't see that of Franklin or Garibaldi. I didn't.
When you say you didn't see that, I mean, did when you saw that the first time, did that...
When I saw that the first time...
Was that something that bothered you? Or
it didn't bother me. It was more of a, okay, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, right.
Huh.
Yeah.
Was there something more appropriate for him to give up?
No, but as the years have gone by, as I've watched the episode on a handful of occasions, I have really come to the conclusion that I think Ivanova, Garibaldi, and Franklin got together and planned that part of it. I mean, you know, they looked to Sheridan as setting the example. I don't think Sheridan would have gone to them and said, you know, let's all get together, turn on uniforms, because that's part of what Delenn would want for the ceremony.
Well, actually, no, that's not part of what she would have wanted, but I think maybe that makes more sense. The other three saw that he was not wearing his uniform because he didn't approve of or he couldn't live with what it stood for. I think he said in this episode, my hypocrisy only goes so far.
Right.
So I think maybe the other three doing it in support of him not wearing it anymore, that makes sense. I never thought of it like that.
Yeah. But at that point, you know, we get their confessions and they're really quick, but they're poignant and almost painful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Susan comes in and just says, I think I love Talia and walks out. And Garibaldi's, I'm scared all the time
of what might happen if I let go. And then you're like, let go of what? Let go of yourself. Let go of your anger. Let go of your tough guy. What? Let go of what?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's his control. Because he saw what happened when he gave it up. He ended up, well, going back on the sauce.
Well, see, that's now, you know, if you want to delve into some of the psyche of the addict and the alcoholic, the thing is that when the addict is really at his most weak is when he is trying desperately to maintain control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It causes more trouble than it keeps him out of when he's trying to over-control a situation.
Fear, the big fear is letting go because you don't know what happens. I mean, that's the whole surrender part of that thing. And that's, you know, and it's scary. And that and it's a scary, scary thing. And I can see where Garibaldi is with that. It's frightening, you know, to not be in control. And that's, you know, and that's, that plays into why he gets into security. You want to talk about being in control. You know, I don't see Garibaldi necessarily as having the big, huge power trip, but being a policeman is definitely all about keeping order and keeping control. And, you know, that's trying to externalize the things that you have difficulty with internally. You know, he's a man who's definitely not at peace with himself that way. And then on the heels of that, Franklin, yeah. I think I have a problem.
Yeah. And that that hint, the fact that it takes like another season for that hint to fully play out is kind of cool.
Yeah. For even for that, and then again, back to the addict, you know, he recognizes he might have a problem, but he is not in a place. You know, that's almost the irony of it. Here's this, you know, here's this rebirth ceremony. We're supposed to let go of something, and it's a big step to say you've got a problem, but he's still not at a place where he can let go of that.
And honestly, we haven't actually seen him overuse it. You've literally just been here or there in the middle of a crisis is the only time.
Right.
But, you know.
Well, there was the time in Earhart's where he slips off to the little officer's room.
Had that happened? I thought that was later. Had that happened already?
No.
I think
it
had.
Yeah, no, that was earlier. That was earlier because Garibaldi had the dinner with Franklin. I'm trying to remember what episode that was, and it's eluding me now. But, yes, it was in the second year.
Yeah, he's tired, all worn out, and then comes back. He's
I'm going to go dance with that little number. And, yeah.
We have everybody rebirth, so to speak, and, quote, in anticipation of your actions, Delenn has left you a gift. Delenn has made you a gift, which I've left in your quarters.
Yeah. Of course, never mind how he got into their quarters.
Yeah, that'd be a question I'd want, you know, like Mr. Garibaldi might say, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Now, it could be, I mean, you know, to be fair, maybe there was, you know, something where Lanier cleared that with Garibaldi as part of the ceremony, but
we do know
I kind of like to think that he jimmied the locks and got in.
Well, he previously had access to Mr. Garibaldi's quarters to put together the motorcycle. So
this is true.
Yeah, so we don't know. Anything could have happened there, but yeah. So, and we see the new Army of Light uniforms, which I have always liked, by the way.
Oh, those are some of the sharpest outfits ever created for any television show anywhere.
Yes.
And as Sev says in the Sevalon 5 cartoon, commenting on the black, midnight black uniforms, uniforms for the Army of Light, serving the forces of irony.
Why not? Why not use forces of darkness to fight for the light?
Right.
It's possible. It is possible.
Well, you know, it would be facile to say that irony is intentional, you know, that, I mean, given the gray nature of so much of the saga of Babylon 5, that, yeah, I mean, I could see that sort of, you know, you look at the symbol of the yin and the yang, you know, you've got the white area with the one spot of black, which indicates that even in the pure white, you have the seed of the negative or the receptive, and same with the black area with the spot of white to show that it has the seed of light or positive energy. It's the same deal here. However, I really think it boils down to this. Those are just cool-looking uniforms.
And I don't know, we haven't talked about the B story yet. Londo demanding an audience with Lord Rifa.
Ah, yes.
You will do. Yes. The I don't know if it's really the full.
It's not a
B story, but that one segment has so much impact on a lot of things that come later. You have to mention it. Yeah. So
right.
Yeah. Londo decides that. Yeah, Londo decides that it's time for Rifa to come to him instead of him going to the court. And Londo wants to make a deal with Rifa. It's like, our front lines. Notice the emphasis on the word lines.
Yeah.
Are many. It's like, is there anyone not on our borders, quote, that we are not at war with? And Reefa's arrogance just comes right on through. He's like, hey, yeah, we have backup, no problem. And what was the line? Only an idiot would fight a war on two fronts. Only the heir to the throne of the kingdom of idiots would fight a war on 12 fronts.
Sorry. Yeah. And Reefa, you know, he's sitting there thinking, well, you know, I've got the shadows backing me up. And we know at this point, Morden has said as much that he's contacted Reefa.
Yeah. He actually denies it. He denies it at first. He says, I don't know what you're talking about. It's like, I want you to cease your dealings with Mr. Morden. What? I don't know what you're talking about. And he plays the recording of Morden saying, right. We've contacted Lord Reefa. So, I'm asking you nicely not to deal with Mr. Morden again. He said, why? Because I'm asking you nicely and because I've poisoned your drink.
With your drink, yeah.
He's like, what?
He's like, yeah, Arifa's face at that point was like,
He's like, and Londo's viciousness when he's describing it, he's like, the poison was a part of the old republic and we are going back to the old ways. And what did he say? He says, the poison is very ingenious. It comes in two parts. The first part can sit in your digestive and intestinal tract for years. The second part can be introduced any time later. The two parts mix, have a little party in your cardiovascular system. I like that. And have a little party, the way he said that, with such just dripping, just glee, vicious glee, was just,
And venom, too.
And he's like, you know, these people are dangerous. We don't know what they really want. Why, if they are so powerful, why do we have to do their fighting for him? Will you wake up and go away? Yeah. And,
But that turns around and bites him in the tail later on.
Oh, it bites him a couple of times.
Yes. Right. And that's the thing. You know, Londo is desperately trying to sever his connections with the shadows. And frankly, even though he has said, you know, goodbye to Mr. Morden, he knows that he's responsible for the shadows being involved in the affairs of the Centauri Republic.
Mm-hmm.
So he is trying everything he can to end that. And you know, to a certain extent, you know, Reefa thinks he's immune to anything because he's got the shadows backing him. And then to find out that, well, he's, you know, been poisoned, you can see that veil of arrogance drops away.
Mm-hmm.
Londo, by the same token, is, his hearts are in the right place. He's doing this for the Republic, but he thinks that he has brought an end to this and naively does not anticipate the fact that, or the level of commitment, shall we say, of Mr. Morden's associates to using the Centauri Republic to further their aims.
Yes. And several different things happen because of this. You see that Lord Reefa really believes that because of the shadows, he will be, you know, put in succession to the throne, whereas Londo already knows that he is pretty much going to, you know, he's seen it. Reefa wants it. Londo has resigned himself to the fact that he's going to get it even though he doesn't want it. And you have to wonder, is that, you know, just selfishness on Londo's part, that he thinks only he can be a good enough emperor to, you know, take the Centauri back to where they need to be, that he doesn't want Reefa to do it, or?
No, I think we're starting to get a sense of the despair that Londo feels about the situation. I don't think he thinks, oh, I'm going to poison Reefa, get him out of the way because, you know, it's already ordained that I'm emperor. I think he, even the same patriotism and love for the Republic that caused him in his arrogance to shake the hands of Mr. Morden, that same patriotism is trying to make it so, I think, so that in his mind that when he does finally ascend to the throne of the emperor, that it is a pure, or he's hoping it's a purer, more nobler action. But I think he also fears that it is a curse as opposed to a blessing. Yeah, I don't really honestly think that Londo at this point thinks that he is going, you know, that by him becoming emperor, things are going to be glorious and wonderful again. None of the visions show that. They show him as this decrepit old man in a dark room. You know, I mean, there's no joy. There's no, you know, throngs of adoration. He's alone in all of his visions.
That's true.
You know, he's a broken man. So I think that what he's clinging to is to at least make it so that when he is, hopefully, that when he ascends to the throne, the Republic is in good shape for whoever takes it over afterwards. But I think that, you know, well, of course, when it comes down to it, you know, he keeps going back and forth. When okay, spoiler alert, Brad, has Christina seen this part?
No, but I don't think she didn't listen to the podcast anyway. Actually, I try to avoid her from listening to
okay,
it.
Okay, because then I was going to say, because when Deera comes to the station in a body bag...
Oh, yeah, we made it to that. We finished out season 3.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Other things
then,
are set
then that's
motion.
When Londo goes back to Morden and says, the rest of the galaxy can burn for all I care. You know, get me revenge on the people who did this.
Yep.
You know, and then screw the rest of it. That's not somebody who's at that point thinking nice thoughts.
Nope.
So, anyways, but again, that's the kind of thing. Londo, by poisoning Reefa, doesn't think beyond, you know, he thinks by just threatening Reefa's life, he's tidied up a loose end. No, he simply just added another knot to the noose.
Do you think he's trying to avoid what he saw in the vision?
No.
Before no. that bad, trying to...
If he were trying to avoid it,
alter destiny?
No, if he were trying to avoid it, I think he would have let, you know, sit back and let Reefa accrue that power that would have put him in line for the throne instead of taking steps to make sure that Reefa doesn't dare interfere with him again.
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. I think Londo is resigned to the prophecy. I think the prophecy of Lady Morella cemented in his mind that this is what is to be. But as he says, you know, whether this is something for good or something for ill, I can no longer say. And I think that's what he's fighting for at this point, to make it something good as opposed to something evil.
Okay, so any final thoughts?
An intense episode. Just like I said earlier, it's more internal as opposed to external, but still just as important. And then to close with, we have the words of Sheridan that echo Laurel Takashima's at the end of the gathering.
Oh, yeah.
And Babylon 5 is open for business.
Well, that will do it for our deep geeking for the rest of 2007.
Yeah.
So we'll come back in a moment.
This is Captain Yarsto, EAS Netherlands.
Area Planum, Command Post, reporting.
This is NBS-1, Squad Leader Tijan.
We are not hostile. I repeat, we are not hostile.
The Corps is mother, the Corps is father.
I will need to protect the interests of our people.
Rebels, we fought here at Orion 7 in the name of freedom.
Free-Edged Sword, Episode 21, Across the River of Fire.
Second jump area detected. Enemy combatants appear to be two Hyperion-class ships and no additional fighters detected. Assuming full onboard ship complements, though. They appear to be headed for the processing nodes in Sector 15. We're moving in through the asteroid fields to maintain cover for as long as possible.
All Psi-Corps ships approaching firing radius. Black Omegas, monitor the Narn. Be prepared whichever way they jump.
All fighter groups prepare to fire. Target capital ships first, fighters only as necessary. Mark weapon systems as priority targets. I repeat, weapons are priority targets. Concentrate on Omega-class ships when possible. Leave the Hyperions for later.
All Psi-Corps ships maintain Earth Force protocols. Do not break formation until contact with the enemy.
This is MBS-1. Maximum power to weapons. Remember your orders and remain in formation. We need to remain within the battle group, but distinct and ready to act on our own. Approaching optimum range.
Helm, drift us to the right on maneuvering thrusters. If we're too far on the flank, we'll have to spring our surprise on the enemy sooner than planned.
Com section. Try to clear a better channel to Commander Jacobs, but leave the bandwidth for the CNC net intact.
NBS 2 to NBS 1. You are correct. They're trying to come around us on the left.
Of course. They're not quite sure of our intentions yet. Let them come in further. Be ready to change attack vectors on my command. MBS 2, do you see the same data I do?
Was this what you were expecting?
It is. We'll need to adjust. EAS Hammurabi, we're coming around your 6. We could use some additional firepower.
Captain Blake to Hammurabi Fighter Squadron. Stay close to the non fighters and coordinate your fire to maximize tactical effect. Tactical, prepare the main forward batteries to fire. Take point defense crews to standby.
All ships, open fire.
Open fire.
Fire at will.
Looks like we chose well. All right, concentrate on the Black Omegas to start with. Let the Furies from the Hammurabi inflict the most damage, but hold nothing back.
New orders for 1st Fighter Reserve. Join the main force and deploy for interceptor fire on the left flank. Concentrate on defensive fire, but you're clear to dogfight if necessary.
Hattusha and Loki, move forward. Try to keep the fire away from Courageous. Nova-class ships are lighter on the interceptors, but if we can shield her, she packs quite a punch.
Recalibrate the weapons again, Tactical. We're still nowhere near full strength, and it's only going to grow more obvious as the range drops.
Good. Prepare to fall back. We can't tangle with their fighters so close to the capital ships. MBS-2, contact our friends and let them know. Tell them we need to draw the Omegas back to the Hammurabi.
Omegas, tighten up! Watch each other's back! Tam, get more Earth Force support for the Omegas!
Negative. Force projections show the Omegas doing fine.
Through that gauntlet?
Their superior skills have been factored in.
Shock. They're coming, but their formation is more coordinated than I expected. We'll have to split them up more.
Target those enemy fighters. Prepare to redirect interceptors as well as main weapons on my mark. Mark.
We're losing the Omegas. I told you they needed support, Tam. No skill set could survive that barrage.
Very well. I'm sending in another wave now.
Free-Edged Sword is brought to you by Voices of Babylon.
And we're back to close up this crazy pre-holiday show and
painful, just painful.
It's
really
not,
you would think
painful.
You know what happened to that practice makes perfect. We've done, what is this, like episode 94, 95, something like that, right?
Yeah, right.
Two years of it, and it's just it's a well-oiled machine, except all the oil is outside of the machine, just sort of coating it, dripping off of it in a gunky kind of way, you know.
Well, Cal Ripken Senior used to tell Junior, practice doesn't make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect. And
Yes.
Yeah.
And therein lies the problem.
Right, exactly.
Wow. Well,
all right. Another solution to the problem solved.
Okay.
I got nothing.
Hey, you know what else, Tim? You know what else? I know this
what?
Will have, this is your cup of tea because you're old enough. Because you're old
what's
enough.
What's that?
Ike Turner died today.
Aww.
Evil Knievel.
Yeah, listen to Mike
too.
Back there. Mike,
really?
Mike. Yeah, Mike. Yeah. I know. You probably slept with him, didn't you?
Everybody slept with Ike.
Yeah, no. Evil Knievel died a couple weeks ago, too. That
yeah,
one.
Yeah,
I was
exactly.
Like, whoa, what happened there?
Some of our real heroes are dropping here now.
Yeah. And everybody under the age of 30 is going, who?
Ike, what?
That's right.
Wasn't he the president before Kennedy?
Oh.
It's the second part of that candy, Mike and Ike. So that's, do those even exist anymore?
Wow.
I don't know. Do they?
Now that really was
old.
That's
anyway.
Really, yeah, exactly.
Anyway, Do we have any feedback for today?
Michael, what have you got, Michael?
Well,
you got
they, some. They don't send them to Tim. They send them to me now because they know where the real power lies in this show. So I'm gonna, I'll play it for you.
Thanks, Mike.
Hi, guys. It's Edmund from Greenville. At the end of the live feed last week, after I'd mentioned our sympathy for the Writers Guild strike, Jeffrey speculated that I might start picketing the Draco Vista studios. However, since your show is obviously unscripted, I will not be seen.
Yeah,
I guess we don't have to worry about that.
Because they're
unscripted.
It's clear.
Wait a minute.
Well, actually, in honor of the strike, I'm actually closing down the studios for a couple weeks.
We are being lumped in with reality shows and unscripted entertainment. Oh, no.
No.
We're not?
No.
Okay.
No. We're shutting down.
We're shutting down. The studio's going dark.
And it's apparent that there is no talent here, so therefore there couldn't possibly any be. You know, there's no way that we could have a unified strike, even if we wanted to, because we're not smart enough.
We are smart enough. We're just not
Marsh Brothers.
Yeah, we are not. We are smart enough. We're just not creative enough at this point in time.
Could you imagine us all trying to strike? Like, we wouldn't get the address right. None of us would show up at the same place. You know,
Instead you were bringing the signs. No?
Yeah, exactly. Tim,
I'd
your
bring
sign.
Scotch,
your sign.
Jeffrey bring tequila.
That literally, all of that right there sounds like a trip to a con for us.
Yeah, exactly.
Getting the address wrong, showing up in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Tim's picket sign would say "wag." Brad's would say "gaw."
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
There you go, Michael. You see that? Here I am saying that there's no talent, and Michael said, I've got a 23-second thing, and I said, we can milk that for more than a minute, and we have. So
We definitely have.
We can make a train wreck look good.
Now we just need to interview Brad for like 10 minutes, and we've got 30 minutes.
There's our show! Phew. I will take this end of your opportunity to thank Brad again for all his work in keeping this series alive.
Yes,
without
absolutely.
Whom we would be.
Thank you. Definitely. Big thanks to Brad for picking up some of the editing slack with both
slack.
I'm
a slacker now.
No, not the slack. Just you needed more time to do other things
like video.
Because
that cuttlefish episode was so incredibly important.
But Brad has done a bang up job editing both Babylon Podcast and Kick-Ass Mystic Ninjas. So I just, you know, happy Christmas, dude.
Happy Christmas to Brad.
It's been a lot of fun doing it, and I was honored that you let me do it.
Not a problem. I'm going to honor you more.
Careful what you ask for.
Yeah.
What's the chances you'll re-up on your contract there, Brad?
Got to hold out till the end there for negotiations.
Uh-huh.
Well, let's see. The end is coming up right about now.
So I guess we are done for this episode?
I guess.
I think so, yeah.
Well, if
I'm sure the audience
tuned out about 2 minutes ago, but seriously, if you have your
20
own
20 minutes of content, 40 minutes of filler, welcome to Babylon 5.
Oh, no,
man,
that sounds more like our pod culture to me.
It does. If you want to send in your email comments so that someday Tim will read them to us, that email address is babylonpodcast@gmail.com. Or if you want to email in your own pre-recorded comment, that's the same address to use. Or if you don't have your own recording equipment, call the number. The number
Mike's got stuff. He'll sell you shit. stuff.
That number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year the train jumped the track.
And we'll see you next year.
Merry Christmas!
On the other side of the gate.